This is The Conversation. It's episode 122 with Eileen Cowan, Los Angeles-based photographer, video artist, and all-around menschy person. We're still on our string of having menschian, if that's a word, guests. So here's another in that line. And we are joined once again by the venerable Deb Cloudman. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com. And this is the first episode of 2016. How are my holidays? How are your holidays? How are my holidays? I got through them, is the line that I like to use. I went somewhere cold, very cold for several days, and there was no skiing or other winter sports involved. So, needless to say, it wasn't vacation per se. Before I tell you more about the upcoming episode with Eileen Cowan, I want to tell you a little bit about the last episode that we put out, which is with the co-executive editor of Art News and art critic Andrew Russeth. We talk about just about everything going on in New York, from the lawsuit between Stefan Simkowitz and one of his artists. We also talk about a former charge of Simkowitz's Oscar Murillo. And we talk about the 100-year-old, now New York-based painter Carmen Herrera. We also talk about David Hammons, and he talks about sweets, which he is a big aficionado of, and there are some great picks to go along with that. So check that out. That's episode 121. Conversation with Eileen Cowan. We talk about her long and varied career teaching at Cal State Fullerton. We also talk about her growing up in New York, and but yet living her career life in Los Angeles, and the way that her work has been perceived by the respective art critics in either coast. We also talk about her being in the Biennial in the early 80s. And there is a special bonus segment after we recorded initially with Deb Cloudman. I got on the phone with Eileen, and we had a mini episode in itself in about 10 minutes. So definitely check that out towards the end. That's about it for now. I will talk to you a little bit more on the back end. Thank you very much for being here. I will talk to you then. This is The Conversation, live in the room. And I am so grateful to be joined finally after a long hiatus by Deb Cloudman. Welcome back.
I am so happy to be back.
It was hot last time we did it, wasn't it?
I know. I feel like it was summertime.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the opposite of right now, where it's really cold. And
Pre-winter, but freezing nonetheless.
Yeah, yeah.
And our guest today is Eileen Cowan. Hello.
Hello.
Well, there's so many places we could start with you, Eileen, but I guess let's tick off a few things. So you taught for about 30 years, is that right?
Almost 40.
Almost 40 years, but in different places.
I taught for 4.5 years in a little school in New Hampshire called Franconia College. Mm. The claim to fame was that Leon Botstein, who was the youngest college, he was college president at 23 years old.
Wow.
And there was the rest at Fullerton? The rest of your teaching?
Yeah, Cal State Fullerton.
So Cal State Fullerton for like
33 years.
33 years.
Wow.
Got it. Okay.
And I lived through it.
You lived through it. Okay, well, we'll get to that. But the other thing I wanted to tick off is that you grew up in New York, mm-hmm. have spent a lot of time there, but have been in L.A. for, I guess, obviously, for 35 or so years.
Since 1975.
Wow. Okay. So where do you see yourself in terms of identity with geography? Because you obviously hold on to some New York cultural connections, right?
I do. You know, my closest friends are there. My sister moved back there 4 years ago. I have to say that my art community, though, is in L.A. I have artist friends in New York, but my art community is here now.
Right, right.
Even though I feel, when I go to New York, it feels like home to me still.
Right.
Right. Because you grew up there, and it's ingrained.
And just that the geography of it, it feels normal to me, as opposed to here.
Right.
You know, the big buildings, walking through the streets, the people, that feels comfortable to me.
Well, that's what
Whereas here, it doesn't you know, it's, I still kind of go, where is everybody? Yeah.
So then I think one of the obvious questions is, if you subsumed your New York lifestyle for virtually your whole adult life, why? Because it's practical? Because you can live out here?
I had a job here.
Yeah.
I met my husband out here, and he loves it here. And I don't think I could have the same things there. You know, we have...
Yeah.
It started out as a rent-controlled apartment that went condo in Santa Monica, and I have a studio. And I just don't think I could afford that in New York.
Yep.
Well, if you were there... When you moved out here, though, in the 70s, you may have been able to have those things. But it wasn't... Just wasn't in the cards.
But I didn't have a job.
What were you doing before you got the job out here in California?
That was in New Hampshire, the Franconia.
Oh,
see, I went
okay.
from Franconia, and then I did sort of a guest artist position at Cal State Fullerton. Mm. And then the job came up, and first I didn't even think that I would. It just never occurred to me that I could live on the West Coast right. at all. I'm so East Coast. And then I thought, why not just apply for it? And then I got it.
So the New Hampshire gig was your entry into the teaching. Yeah. And so you had to sort of pay your dues for a few years.
I love the New Hampshire thing, but, you know, I realized I kind of left before the ship sunk. Because when Leon Botstein left and went to Bard College, he's still president of Bard.
Oh, he's the Bard guy.
He's the Bard guy.
Who's notorious.
Yeah.
Right.
Would you like to talk about what he was like when he was a young man, as it were?
He's probably exactly the same. I mean, he just was like the Renaissance guy. He was he can play the violin, and he conducted the orchestra. He's now head of the American Symphony Orchestra.
Wow.
And he just did that. You know, he taught history. He just blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
And then when you came out, how did you find sort of building an artist community here while also teaching in 1975?
I had one already.
Oh.
I had a ready-made one when I came here.
That's lovely.
How did you do that?
Well, you know, the fine art photography community was very tight, kind of. And, you know, I would see people at conferences, or they would, you know, people who do guest lectures. And so I knew a lot of people here when I came out here. Like, do you know who Robert Heineken was?
Sure.
Robert Heineken, who gave me my diploma at UCLA.
Oh, my God. Well, Robert Heineken was a very dear friend of mine, and I've known him before that. And then Robert Fichter, who worked for a while out here with Robert Heineken before he went back to Florida, was my boyfriend for a while. And so then I would come out here to visit him, and then I met Daryl Kern, who taught at Cal State Fullerton. Wow. And it was just this big...
And it was a much smaller world then, so...
It was. We all knew each other, and everybody...
Did everybody get along?
Yes.
Wow. That's crazy. That's unimaginable now.
And do you want to know what else? Let's say a curator from the East Coast came to see me.
Yeah.
Then I would invite everybody else over to meet that curator. Does that sound
very lovely?
Sounds like the glory days.
Like fairy tales can come true.
Fairy tales. Well, let's take it to a darker place, because you actually made me think of something that I wanted to ask about when you said, you know, this curator that you introduced to everybody, which is your video studio visit, which, for people who haven't seen it, can go to your website and watch an excerpt of it. But basically, it's a scenario that a lot of artists have experienced, which is... They have a slated time just for arrival, and it gets pushed back ad infinitum, basically. And you basically play that out. So I think the first question is, that's based on a real experience?
Yes.
Many?
Or 8,000 real experiences?
No, there was one that was particularly horrible.
Can you say who it was?
I don't even remember her name.
Well, what institution?
Perfect. It was an institution in Oregon, something up north, and somebody had... And this is very unusual now. Someone actually recommended her to see my work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very unusual now. That does not happen anymore at all. And she was late, and she kept calling me, you know. And I just, part of me wanted to say, it's okay, never mind.
Right.
But then I felt it might be insulting to the person who recommended me.
Right.
But she didn't know anything about my work when she arrived.
Oh, gosh.
And there is something called Google.
I've heard of that.
What year was that studio visit?
I don't know. Whatever year that video was from. Wasn't
it 2000? Oh, it was that year.
Yeah. I mean, it was, yes. I mean, I looked her up.
Right.
Obviously, I put her name out of my mind. Right. So I don't remember it. But I looked her up, but she actually never didn't look me up at all.
Sounds like the recommendation was only sort of a, it wasn't really completely addressed by your friend. It was flattering, but I should probably just do it because it's better to do it than to just not know what happens.
Well, I don't know if this is in the excerpt, but there's this funny thing where I, you know, another friend calls and said, and I said, I can't believe it. You know, I'm just, you feel so diminished or something in some way, right? So she said, just suck it up. You have to just suck it up. And then she said, like, what's her name? Where she's from?
Right.
Where she's from? Like, maybe I can get in on this too kind of thing. Then it just becomes funny. Then I thought I have to make a video about this.
Because the part where you're dancing is maybe my favorite thing I've seen in a video in a very, very long time. It's so good. And I have to say, I've also been the asshole who completely missed a studio visit that I scheduled, you know, weeks in advance and didn't transfer to the right calendar and had an artist call me and say, so are you still coming, you know, an hour later? And I just wanted to, you know, like, you know, wrap a noose around my neck and just be over because I felt so terrible about it. But I do think that there is a culture at this point of people being overextended, not managing their time well, and not feeling like they need to do the footwork to be prepared to come in the way that maybe people used to.
But at least you feel like you wanted to wrap a noose around
your
neck.
That's true.
I mean, that gives you a lot of points because really a lot of people don't. I had someone from Chinatown. He stood me up twice.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe, I mean, the second time I said, oh, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
You know, twice. Then I said, I don't need to have a studio visit with you, really.
Right. It does give you, I mean, it definitely does give you an indication of the priorities and personality type that you are dealing with. To a degree, but yeah, it's kind of a frustrating state of affairs that is no longer seen as important, you know, preparing.
I think as opposed to your, you know, just mistaking it on the calendar,
right.
It's when somebody postpones that same day, you know, and then postpones again, there's a very strong subtext of power being played out.
Yeah.
Well, actually that video is about that. It's all about power.
Yeah.
And then the interesting flip side, though, of the video is that after the studio visit has presumably ended, you have the debris of all of your work being scattered about, which is actually kind of encouraging because it suggests that they wanted to see it, everything, right? So, I mean, is there a silver lining?
No, that wasn't that studio visit. That was a different studio visit.
You mixed studio visits in your video.
I mixed studio visits, yes. Because that first one where she came in and I said, well, how much time do we have? Because, you know, I have video. I have all this.
Right.
And she said, I have about 20 minutes. So what I really wanted to show was how much work is involved in a studio visit.
Definitely.
I mean, it's not just where you go, okay, I'm just going to, you know, walk in 5 minutes before and pull some stuff together.
Right.
It is a lot of work. And then you have to put everything back.
Yeah.
And which, if you've got it under wraps, takes quite a while.
And I don't have an assistant.
Right.
I'm not one of those artists that has an assistant. Yeah.
Well, you're not one of those artists for many reasons, clearly, which we'll get to. I'm interested in the photographer ghetto. That came to mind as we were talking about the studios, that I was picturing, you know, you getting stuff out of the flat files, and then you have the acetate or whatever it is, you know, over, and you're. And I was just thinking about something that came up when you mentioned your community, and I wonder what your cognizance of the sort of fine art photography ghetto has been over the years. In a literal sense, because photography was not the same thing it is now, you know, in the marketplace. It was much more of it, you know, it's had various periods where it's been a ghetto in that it's the curators, like that woman, for example, and museums in general for a long time, you know, relegated it to a certain area. that's obviously changed in the last 10 or 15, whatever years, however when you whatever you want to call it. But I'm just wondering if this was something you were aware of on a institutional level and then maybe also on kind of a community cultural level at some point.
I think, you know, years ago, a long time ago, when I had that community, and I have to say that I felt more comfortable in the California community than the East Coast, because the East Coast, with people like Lee Friedlander, that just wasn't my kind of work. Right. So the Robert Heinegan community, that was more my kind of work, you know. And, you know, it just crossed a lot of boundaries. In fact, you know, I remember going to this gallery and they'd say, well, this isn't photography.
Right.
Wow.
When I'm looking at my work, and I'd say, well, you know, okay. But then I had another thing where someone, a gallery in San Francisco, said, well, you know, this is set up. And I said, yeah, it is set up. It's set up to look set up.
Right.
You know, and photography is not supposed to be set up according to this person. So there were a lot of those things that you're always kind of fighting against in some way. But I never really was much of, I just do my work.
Yeah.
If you're interested in it, fine. If you're not interested in it, that's fine. I was not one of those people that had a crusade about it in any way.
Right.
I think now there is not that community anymore.
Right.
You know, I don't have friends who are in the photography field. You know, I have video friends and painter friends and sculptor friends. It's just not the same thing.
Right.
At all now.
Did you feel in that time, I mean, as much as you're saying that you were really just interested in your work and not on a crusade, did you feel in the sense of community that you were part of a movement of people that were working in a particular way? Or did you always feel like an individual kind of amongst friends?
No, I feel like I was part of a movement. And I keep mentioning Robert Heinegan, who has had a big resurgence now. I mean, just had a show at the Museum of Modern Art. Right.
Yep, definitely.
I mean, he came here. I mean, you know, is it the Hammer?
Yeah.
I'm sorry he's dead and I can't, you know, enjoy it. I really am. It just, you know, that kind of stuff pisses me off.
Absolutely.
You know? So, but I just think that there was a kind of work that just, you know, it wasn't photography really, and it wasn't, but it was sort of sculpture, and maybe it had a little painting, and maybe it just had everything. And now nobody really thinks about it. We don't have those kind of boundaries anymore.
At the time, utilizing photography as a tool was less comfortable for people, or people didn't know how to categorize it. I mean, and you were using it as a tool in a certain sense, I would say, only in that, as you said, people were uncomfortable with the fact that it was staged, with the fact that you were resisting the idea of capturing a natural moment or a natural...
Right, but early work even before that was, you know, I was kind of a drawing and printmaking major in college, and so my work had that kind of combination of those elements to it. And I never really thought about that it had to be such a strict category.
Right.
I never did.
Well, you mentioned that you were the New York community that you didn't feel connected to. What was the pictures, quote unquote, picture generation starting when you were still there, or was that after you left?
Oh, no. That was...
Well, after you left.
Yes, that was like 1980, you know, like...
And you were, you were long gone.
And I have to say, I was in a lot of those shows.
Yeah.
Did you know any of those people?
No.
Interesting.
Like when I was in the Whitney Biennial in 1982, which I'll never be in again, but let's just say then I was.
Right.
And Cindy Sherman was in that, and we just kind of she knew my work, I knew her work, you know, but that was different then.
Yeah.
Biennials, I'm glad you mentioned that. Biennials were different back in the 80s, for sure. What was it like for you?
You know how you think, if I could just be in the Whitney Biennial.
Right.
Did it? But that's the thing. I mean, I'm very interested to hear where this goes, but was it even close to that kind of importance that it obviously has been, and maybe it's got kind of even gone downhill in some ways, but in the last, you know, 15, 20 years?
Well, when I got in the Whitney Biennial with this early family work, I was mentioned in a lot of the reviews, which was a big thing for me. It was amazing for me.
For anyone.
Really.
Yeah.
But then after that, you know, you always think, okay, this is it. This is my big moment.
Yeah.
And then nothing happened after that. Absolutely nothing. And I think, okay, I guess that was that.
Right.
You know, you kind of say, oh, I can't wait, you know, when you're in college or whatever.
Right.
Oh, my God, if I could just be in the Whitney Biennial or whatever. And then there you are. You're in it, and then...
Well, like, you know, the way that I've talked about the Biennial in recent years or on this podcast is that you have people who are already established, you know, and a lot of superstars. And then you have these sort of surprise people like that nobody's heard of, you know, particularly from non-art centers.
Right.
And I wonder, though, if at the time... LA or California, even, you know, anything outside of New York was all that basically. And so I wonder to what degree you're being an LA/California artist, not being once you are in that show, having a lot of momentum carried over into New York was what it was about.
Maybe, but I have to say, you know, when I moved out here, I was showing, you know, and then I was showing in New York. I didn't show in LA for a long time.
Mm.
And then my first review from Suzanne Muchnick was like, well, these are, you know, set up and they're not interesting or some, you know, kind of horrible thing, you know. And then I got another review later for another show, same thing. So they just didn't go for me out here.
Right.
I mean, the critics didn't really. And I had galleries in New York.
Right.
And then somewhere in the 80s, I got a gallery here.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I was showing both places, and now I haven't had a gallery for 20 years. But then mostly I was, and I got good reviews in New York, but I didn't get good reviews here at all.
What impact do you think the reviews in either place were?
Oh, I don't think anything. I mean, I had this review once. It's my favorite review now, okay? I show that family work everywhere, and I don't even like to talk about that family work much at all. I refused to show it in a show last year. I refused.
Good for you.
Wasn't. But so I'm in the show in North Carolina, and he writes, Eileen Cowan has the visual sensibility of a lug wrench.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So then I said to my husband, what's a lug wrench? And then he said, well, why do you want to know? I said, well, no, I just want to know. I didn't even show it to him. You know, because it's like you read that and you go, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Ugh. And so I put it away. And then I finally, now I just tell everybody about it because I thought it's just so funny to me now. But then it was like, oh.
It hurt.
At the time.
Right.
Of course. And the Suzanne Muchnick show, that hurt also.
Sure, sure. You know? Right. Well, I wonder, you know, the thing that I like to talk about, or Deb and I talked about with David Pagel in particular, is, you know, the stamp of approval. You know, it's like people, when they get that LA Times review, it's in Los Angeles, that is the paper of record for an artist's show. So it goes in the press kit, you know, it's sent out to the email list and so on. And, but ultimately, it doesn't really matter kind of what it says. So in your case, it didn't really seem to matter consequentially as far as your career, but it was kind of a personal dig against you.
It was. And I guess also, I mean, it wasn't as if it didn't hurt. It really felt bad to me because I lived here. But I was getting like good reviews. That one review was on the front page of the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times. So I thought, wow, how could it be so different?
Right.
Really? Like, how can my work be so accepted there and they really get it? And here... they're saying, well, it's set up.
Right.
And then later on, I think she wrote, oh, well, she used to do that horrible setup work, but now the work's kind of more natural looking. I'm going, oh, my God.
So like, interesting. You
know. Well, I think, I imagine Deb and I are both thinking the same thing, which is that these people just weren't ready for your work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And does that seem to be the case? And they just weren't sophisticated enough?
I don't know. I wouldn't say, I don't know, because I don't want to be... You know, I don't want to be critical like
well,
that.
Well, that's the reason.
It is, yeah. I mean, and there, I think it's so interesting that there would be that kind of disconnect and that maybe you needed to be in Los Angeles, separated from the New York community, to make that work that you then were bringing there that had that very theatricality. I also think that, and this is just my perception from some distance and kind of loving that period in LA, but also not experiencing it. So please forgive me if I'm wrong, but I also think that Los Angeles at that time was so self-conscious about its own identity as the purveyor of staged culture that there was a real discomfort with a fine art representation of staging, you know, like that, and this is, again, it's hard to say from this distance, but I really feel like it took LA growing up a little bit more before it didn't have to be defensive against art that it felt was speaking directly to artifice in a certain way. And I don't know.
I think it had a lot to do, though, with ideas about photography.
Right. That makes sense. You
know, and that kind of really old-fashioned ideas about photography that had to be a certain way.
Right. Naturalistic. And
yes.
So interesting. And did you feel like other photographers that you were friends with at the time were coming up against similar roadblocks?
Probably.
Yeah. So interesting. You mentioned before we started, a panel that you did not long ago, and I think you said it was at LAX Art, mm-hmm. That you co-conceived, co-hosted with mm-hmm. Holly Myers, that was about the idea of success in the art world. And I would love to hear a little bit about your thoughts on that, if you would feel comfortable.
She must have got your work, right?
Who, Holly? I don't think she ever wrote about my work. I don't.
Did she ever say anything to you about it?
I can't remember if we talked about it.
She just said, come be on this panel.
We actually talked a lot about, you know, issues around the art world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was really sorry when she moved away, because we had some other things that we had thought might be interesting. You know, I never thought I was someone who would do something like that, but it was just so much fun to talk to her about these kinds of issues.
Oh, was it just the two of you?
No, she did her own. She did them on her own. They were hers.
Oh,
so
right.
These colloquies were hers. But then after I was in the one on the MFA question, I said, you know, I wrote to her and said, boy, have you ever thought about this question, the success question? And then she said, that would be a great idea. And we just had fun getting together and talking about it.
So what was the takeaway from the success session?
I obviously that everybody has a different idea of success. And what happened was, you know, here was this panel, and it was Paul Schimmel, and it was Suzanne Villemotter, but it was Mark Bradford who had gotten a MacArthur, and Anna Sohoy, who was like a young, up-and-coming,
right.
You know, hot artist. And then me, I'm there. And
how did you feel being amongst that crowd?
I felt fine about it, because I try not to be negative about, there's so much negativity in the art world, and sometimes I have to say to friends, please don't complain to me about it. I really don't want to hear that, because would I like to have more success? Would I like not to be auditioning all the time?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I did a video called The Audition, even. Somebody was teaching
we
me.
We saw it.
I saw that. It was great.
But yes, I would. But I think that I love making the work. And when I don't make the work, it depresses me. I'm not a depressing person. I'm a very positive person. So I just love to make the work. And I always say, well, maybe I'll have my Louise Bourgeois moment.
Yeah.
Maybe I will. There's a woman now. She's 99, and she's having a show at the Whitney.
Yeah.
I have a shot at it. I still do, you know.
That's not... Oh, you're talking about Herrera,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Just talked about her on a recent podcast. I didn't know about her at all.
And she's 99.
But you wait a second. Let's back up for a second, because I want the opportunity for you to have your Louise Bourgeois period, mm-hmm. you know, in 20 years or whatever. Great. But you were in the Whitney Biennial, so let's not suggest that you've been off the map.
Oh, no. I have had... Okay, so here's what you have to think about. Do you want that kind of career that just kind of goes way up there?
Right.
And then you have to maintain something,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, and have this big production with this, you know, and getting this. Or do you want to have something like a steady career that you just keep at it? I've had a pretty steady career. I have. I was in a show at the Getty three
right.
years ago. I mean, I'm not... No, I think... I'm okay. I just, there are things that I would like for myself still. And I, as you probably notice from the studio visit video, I don't really love studio visits.
Right.
I have a few curators that I love to have come to my studio, because I'm not asking them for anything, and it's just the conversation about the work. And that feels really good to me.
Right.
But when you don't have the opportunity to show new work and you make it, then you think, I really would
like. I wonder what that's like.
Well, and I think the challenge for so many people in every area of the art world that I know, not just those of you who are making work, but also people showing it, is balancing the part of the very nature of this world as it is set up that is so consumed with ego. And how do you balance the gratitude for, not to sound too spiritual about it, but how do you balance the gratitude for being able to make a living, whatever it is that you're doing to make that living, whether it's teaching or a different day job or selling your work, and continue to do this thing that you love in a world that day by day seems to be devaluing art in general. You know, how do you maintain this kind of balanced view of that and that sort of positivity, and at the same time recognize that there are certain things that are important to you? And what are those things? Is it that other people are seeing your work? Is it just that you're getting to make work? Is it, you know, a certain level of esteem or awards or the idea that this is going to live on after you die? Like, you know, what are those things that you can look to while still retaining some kind of grounded?
And I've seen people who are very successful, and they're not always happy.
Yes.
They're just not always happy.
Pretty much across the board in all walks of life, I would say that's true. But right. Yes, definitely.
But Michael, I think one of the things you said, like, I don't think it would have worked for me to be on that panel if I didn't have some success, if it was just one of those artists who never had anything.
Right.
I think it only worked because I did have success. And what I said, and people appreciate, I said, you have to find other ways. Like, now I've never thought I'd be doing public art, but now I'm doing some public art.
Yeah.
I'm working on a very big project now, and I had done some airport projects, but that gets the conversation about my work out again. So that's what those are the kind of things that I brought up. And I applied for grants, and I got some grants. I just think that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
Okay, I can't do this. Galleries are not interested in my work. So let me try this now.
So is that what you think would have been missing in the standard success arc for your work? Would it have been a more commercial presence? Or would it be at this point on? I'm not necessarily just looking backwards, but, you know, and by commercial, I mean the commercial gallery system, not saying commercialization of your work, but, you know, the standard ideas of, consistent gallery representation and what that does.
Yeah, I don't care about selling my work that much, which of course does not bode well when you want a gallery to maybe be interested in you. But that being said, I mean, I don't mind. I like to sell my work. I just sold something out of my studio. It's great. I got all the money, you know, and everything for it. But for me, it's getting into good group shows.
Right.
Because that's where museum curators go. They go to the galleries. If you're not in a gallery, then they don't remember that you're there.
Right.
And so that's really it. It's having your work in conversation with other artists' work so that, you know, you're always involved in that dialogue. And that's what's missing.
Right.
Sometimes for me.
And that makes sense.
Yeah. The money thing, not, you know, I've gotten a number of grants over the last couple of years, and then, you know, your tax dollars at work pays my pension from Cal State Fullerton.
Right.
So, you know,
which I would say is well earned after.
I worked in the mines for 33 years, and now I get my just rewards.
You want to talk about the mines a little bit?
The mines? Oh, the mines. The student mines?
I meant mines as in...
M-I-N-E-S?
Yeah, if you...
Oh, and I say I worked in the mines?
Yes.
The Cal State system, to me, that's like the real blue-collar system. It's not like, the UC system where they kind of go in like two afternoons or not, you know, whether they... You know,
oh, right. It's a real job. You have to work. Yeah,
have to. And they also expect you, even though it's not a research institution, they expect you to have your creative work because that's how you're supposedly get promoted or whatever, which I don't think I could ever have taught if I wasn't doing my work. I couldn't have gone through it really. I mean, I love my students. I had great students. But what happens at the Cal State is like they've turned into vocational schools. And that's not interesting to me at all. And so I just got increasingly unhappy about that. And then I felt terrible for my students. you know, they come there wanting like a fine art experience, and they keep being forced into a sort of vocational experience. And I thought, now is a good time for me to retire.
Mm.
That makes sense. And huh. Do you feel like that was because of resources, administration, the way things were, if you feel comfortable speaking about it abstractly?
I think it's all of the above. I mean, I always say all of the above.
Right.
Because, you know, they want this, the bodies, they want, you know, they want students in. And sometimes they have parents come in with the students and they say, well, what can my kid do when they get out? I mean, I remember that we had this chair who I didn't get along with really at all. But one of the painting faculty walked in on him advising a painting student, and he was talking this painting student into changing the major to illustration.
Wow.
That's the culture of that.
Wow.
So that was.
And you think it's, to what extent you think it's like that still now that you've left?
I think it is.
Yeah. Even more so, maybe.
Going back to your public sculptures, I was thinking of the, you know, the kissing, blowing kisses and whatnot, and that I recognize some of the people, and I just wonder if you culled from everybody that you know in LA, or if it was all artists, or how that worked.
It wasn't all artists, but I did. What happened was I got an opportunity to do a display case at the airport. And when I was doing this, which I was very excited about because it really reflected my new narrative work. And then they said, you know, we got this space in the Virgin America Terminal. Do you want to, could you do video? And how about your video that you did? I did a 16-channel video of this blowing kisses thing. Mm.
Who was this that asked you this?
The arts administrator at the airport.
Oh, okay.
They just thought, well, it just came up, mm-hmm. and we thought, we want to just try this space, and would you do that as well?
Right.
Absolutely. But then I had to reshoot, because the previous, the 16-channel one, was not HD, and this was going to be, you know, a 50-inch TV, and so I put it out on Facebook.
Facebooked it.
I Facebooked it, and I said, does anybody want to come and do this for me? And people did.
How many people did you get?
I want to say maybe 20. So I got a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It was good. I mean, of course, then I had, you know, like my stepdaughter and her husband and my husband and, you know, and Jeff. And, you know, I just did that. And that was great. It worked out pretty well.
So let's go back to that you haven't been with a gallery for 20 years. And the thing that you were telling Deb and I earlier is that you have been giving away some of your work. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the complexity of where you have evolved with, you know, work and money. Meanwhile, you just mentioned, obviously, like 10 minutes ago, that you just sold the piece and you got all the money for it because you sold out of your studio, which is nice.
Well, I mentioned that only because I had a gallery steal money from me, you know, and like she sold work and didn't tell me. And then we tried to take her to, you know, this is in New York. And so that's why I said that, because I just...
Is that a gallery that's still active?
She is a woman. Yes, she is still... She is still active, but she works out of her house now in New York.
Michael is looking at me, and I can't tell if it's I am accusing you with the eyes of all artists towards the eyes of all dealers, or if it's you got anything for me on this?
No, it's you ask her. That's what it is.
Ask who it is.
Yeah.
I am not going to ask who it is, although you're welcome to.
If she was willing to tell, she would have told us.
Yes, exactly.
You know what? I would love to tell you, but I get worried about it.
Yeah, I don't blame you for that at all.
I am dying to tell you. It's killing me not to tell you.
It's
honestly
so disheartening to me, and I think I've said this on this podcast before, but it's so disheartening how often I hear stories like this. And I have to say, as much as I am not a litigious person, whenever I hear about artists getting screwed over and hear, and then I sued them, it makes me really happy. Not because you had to go through all of the energy and resources to put in that direction legally, but just because I think the prevailing culture of no consequences is a huge reason why it is as prevalent as it is. And it's really great to hear when artists are actually taking initiative to try and rectify it or hold people accountable.
Well, damn, we tried. This other artist and I, we went to the district attorney in New York, you know, like one center street down there, like, you know. And it's not like Law and Order, you know. They don't do the law and then the order in an hour.
Right.
And it went on and on and on. And then the assistant DA, I think she had a heart attack and she wasn't there. Right. Nobody picked it up. And then there you go.
Well, there also, there isn't, because it isn't done that often, there aren't the legal precedents that make it easy for somebody to build that kind of case without feeling confident that an artist has the funds to pay them copious legal fees. And most of their peers are going to say, why are you taking on this case? You're not going to get anything from it. So it's a really big battle on a lot of levels, I think, for artists to actually be heard that way. You can maybe tell that I'm the child of a lawyer. You know, I've got a lawyer on one side and an artist on the other side. So I'm right in the middle of that mix a little bit. But I still think that, you know, making the effort is huge, but it is really hard. See,
now I had this big, I call it my museum project.
Yeah.
And I gifted large bodies of work to LACMA, Santa Barbara, and the Getty.
That's
and then
phenomenal.
One project to MoCA.
So when you're saying give it away, this isn't, you know, I'm at the back of my car giving my friends
no,
my
it's not
work.
Like those turkeys
this
at
is,
the giveaway at Thanksgiving.
Is,
no.
Yeah.
No, no.
Which is fantastic. But also, just for those who don't know, when you do make gifts like that, they still need to go through a process of approval to be added to the collection. So not anybody could call up LACMA and the Getty and MoCA and say, here, would you like to take everything from my studio? And they'll say, yes, we will store this for you for free. And then you get to put on your CV that we are in our collection. I mean, it is, even if you're giving it to them, it is quite an honor to be in
those. Oh, no, it was fantastic. It wasn't even my idea.
Oh, that's
it
wonderful.
Was, the Britt Salveson from LACMA was at my studio. And she said, well, why don't I put together this, you know, group of museums, and we can, and then I had to do a big inventory of my work. It took me 3 months to do an inventory, which was great because I've been wanting to do it for years.
Yeah.
And then they got together without me and they thought, okay, do you want to take this and do you want that one? And they took literally like some of them, like 60 pieces and 70. Yeah. I mean, they really took a lot.
That's phenomenal.
And then they bought, the Getty bought something from me and so did LACMA.
That's amazing.
And it was amazing. But I have had just a couple of bad experiences where a collector had bought my work. I don't have a lot. You know, people always go, and my collectors.
Right.
I can't. But I did have one lovely man who did collect my work. And when he passed away, I never knew what happened to the collection. And then I found that his kids put it up for auction.
Oh,
at
gosh.
Bargain Basement prices.
Oh,
and I tried to buy
it.
I said, I'll buy it. Don't put it up. They wouldn't let me.
Why not?
I don't
know. They wanted to see what they could get for it.
But it was really just horrible. In fact, I mean, one piece I had sold for a lot of money to a museum, just like, and that was Avon did that. They put up their whole collection. And that they put up a piece that they had bought for whatever, $10,000. And then I sold it for almost double.
Right.
Like, you know, years later to a museum. And then I felt terrible that this auction house they chose is putting up for almost nothing. And I thought, I'm so sick of this money thing and, and the whole market thing. And I don't want to fall into that negative hole. And I was so happy when Britt Salveson made that suggestion because, you know, a lot of people will say, well, don't you want to wait and see if it's sold for a lot of money and, you know, whatever. I go, no.
Yeah.
I really don't. I want to make sure that this work that I feel really strongly about, like a lot of my older work and one of a kind, are at these museums that will take good care of it, I hope.
And, of course, not to be crass about your wonderful and totally pure intentions, but the other side of that is, of course, that it does actually increase the value of the work that you make from this point on, because you have increased the market value of your work by having it in all of those collections, even though that was not your purpose.
But I have to say, I was in those collections before.
Right. Even so.
I mean, I've always been. I mean, I've been in. I was in those collections before.
Yeah.
And it hasn't helped me before.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it hasn't. The work that I do just is not, especially at this point in time,
yeah.
where people seem to be moving towards abstraction. My narrative work just not seem to be the kind of work that people feel they could sell.
Yeah. I don't know how long that's going to be true, though. I mean, I think in 5 years, there is a good chance that suddenly you're going to have somebody come to your door and say, you know, you have incredible work and incredible exhibition history, and you're in all of these collections. I'm going to, because it would just take one right person to do that. You've set it up. Not purposefully necessarily, but set it up in a way that, you know, when that dynamic shifts just enough, which I would guess it would.
It isn't anything that I think about, though.
Yeah,
honestly.
Which I think is fantastic. And I'm not trying to shift your mind in that direction at all. I think I'm more saying for those who listen that, you know, these things that you're doing, because you're, as you said, just making your work and doing what feels right to you to be able to continue to do that, none of these things are in any way sabotaging you on that level, which is kind of lovely to see. I don't know if that, I think it's nice for people to know that you can go over here and make the decisions that are best for you for those reasons without thinking about this stuff. And, you know, maybe those things can run in parallel in a way that might support things.
I feel like I'm very lucky.
Yeah.
I really do. I feel like I had this job. You know, there are parts of it I like the students.
Right.
You know, parts of it I didn't like. But even the art job, there are parts you don't like and parts you do like. Every job has, you can't have
Definitely.
The perfect thing. It's not perfect. And now I get to go to my studio every day and make my work. And I have some big projects coming up, and I feel lucky. I do.
What's it like going from having a day job, you know, even as a professor, where you do have some flexibility in theory, to having all that time? You know, because I remember talking to somebody who's went on sabbatical and got to make work all the time, and it was like kind of too much time.
Oh, it's not too much time.
It's never too much time.
Not for me. Yeah. You know, I'm not one of these people that goes, my whole life is about my art. No,
right.
I'm not one of those people. No. You know, I have a...
Thank God.
Yeah. I mean, I have a great husband. You know, we love to do things together. I'm not one of those people. But I do love going to my studio, and I go pretty much, I go almost every day.
Yeah.
And I love to make work. I just, you know... I mean, now I say I have this project, so it's a little bit of a pressure on me, but...
What is the project?
What is the project? It's I'm doing the artwork for the Martin Luther King Metro stop.
Oh, great.
On that line.
And which is where?
It's at the crossroads of Martin Luther King and Crenshaw. It's right there. And so those things take years, but it's my first permanent project. I've never had a permanent public art project.
So it's going to be photographs?
It's on porcelain.
Photographs on porcelain?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
400 feet of art.
Wow.
I'm doing.
How do you put photographs on porcelain?
I have no idea.
So you don't have to deal with the production.
I love that. That's great.
But I have no idea. But apparently they have, you know, it's out for bid now, and they have these two people bidding on it, and they're supposed to, I brought in a file, and I'm supposed to look at it later on and say which one I like the best and all of that. In the meantime, I'm just photographing all the time.
Did you have to apply for the Metro, or did somebody come to you?
No, I was in the, they have these calls, I forgot what they're called, but you know, and then you're part of a pool. So I put it in, I was part of this pool, and then they invited me from the pool to go and do a presentation. So then I did my presentation. You have 15 minutes. There are 15 people standing, staring at you with no expression on their face, not even the hint
Bureaucrats.
Of a smile. Just
right.
No. Even people that I knew, like this wonderful one I love from the airport, but she couldn't acknowledge.
Right.
That, you know, I mean, I couldn't. And then a curator from Mocha, who had just been to my studio. I mean, it was really just like, you can't, you
wow.
have to make believe, like nothing. And they're just staring at you. And you do this thing. And, you know, I've given plenty of talks, and I've done, But I got nervous. I got nervous. And so I did this. But as I was, and I finished talking about the project, one of the women said, "Well, this isn't the project, is it? Oh, I mean, this isn't the project you're going to do, is it?" And I said, "Well, it is. I've just been talking about this for 15 minutes, so yes, it is." So I went, and I said to my husband, "You know, I didn't get this project.
Yeah.
I mean, there is just no way that I got this project." And then they called the next week and said, "I got the project." And apparently some people really pushed for me to get it, because I don't know if they've ever had any these kind of narrative little story things up that I'm working on. So that's a little bit of a pressure on, you know, because there's things I have to do. But I'm working on a video piece that has, I have no idea where I'm ever going to show it, but I'm having a great time with that. I'm working on these small little pieces, and, you know, I'm just doing the work. It's fun.
That's so great.
But I love to go to the movies. I'm a really movie addict.
So. What's your range?
Oh my God.
You like the junk, don't you?
No. I like everything. I like The Hunger Games.
That's the junk.
But yeah. I also like that there's this beautiful movie, Polish movie. It's spelled Ida, but I think it's pronounced Ida. Mm. It's
About the nun, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. I love that movie. I saw it three times. I watched that movie. I went to Laurie Anderson's. I'm pretty much a pretty.
That's fantastic.
You know,
yeah, you're across the board.
Across the board.
I love including the junk. I'm so with you.
And I just, so I'm happy.
You guys have a standing date to go see the new Star Wars movie in 2 weeks.
I know.
Right?
It's happening. It's definitely happening.
So
it'll probably be my third time.
I've seen anything. We just saw this movie called The Big Short. I love that movie because I'm interested.
So you go see the movies right when they come out.
Oh, yeah. I'm right in. I'm right there.
Do you get the senior? Or are you not quite there yet?
No, I'm not quite there yet.
I'm just teasing. No, do you go to the matinees?
Sometimes we'll go late Saturday afternoons, I think. But that has more to do with traffic issues sometimes. Although now that the ArcLight's open in Santa Monica, we can walk there.
Oh, that sounds
sweet.
Nice.
So I like, you know, I am interested in certain things that have, you know, comment on our culture and what's going on politically. And we are missing the Republican debates today, by the way, right now.
And that's a good thing.
Yes, and it's a good thing. But I am interested in that. I mean, I'm not so interested in work that's so didactic and so hit you over the head.
Right.
Because I feel in my work I'm trying to deal with the anxiety of the culture. That's what I say that my work is about almost all the time, the sort of anxiety of the everyday and what's going on in the culture. But I do like work that somehow gets across ideas in a way that, in The Big Short, it was funny, but it's kind of like funny where you go, "Oh my God," like that kind of thing. And I do like that.
I have to ask, being that you are in a relatively idyllic phase now, where exactly does this anxiety come from? Do you draw from the past?
You know, it's so funny about that. It's so funny about that because I have been thinking a lot about this anxiety lately. Mm. I have this wave of anxiety lately. And I'll just say this for your podcast. I go to a therapist once a month now, a little tune-up, just like a little tune-up.
Yeah.
And so last week we spent an hour on this very subject.
Yeah.
I guess, for instance, I will just bring up the Metro Project. I have a yearning for perfection.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Most photographers do, don't they?
I think most artists do. I don't know if just photographers. I mean, I don't.
Photography, though, makes perfection much more black and white, if you will, doesn't it? Anyway, continue.
And I, you know, there's a lot at stake for me here. This is, again, my first public project, and I'm anxious about it.
Mm-hmm.
I really am.
Right, right.
And I had two big shoots coming up, one with a child, and, you know, I'm not that kind of photographer, but I made myself. Like, I rarely leave my studio. And so now I've been going out into this community. Now, I don't call myself a docu-artist. I'm not one of those at all. I don't, you know, it's not a documentary.
Right.
I'm not doing that. But I love the idea of, like, kind of just sneaking some things from the community in this piece so the community recognizes themselves in this public art piece. So here I am, and I'm out there, and I'm not used to that.
Yeah.
And so I'm putting myself, and I like to put myself in positions that make me nervous. I do. But I have to recognize that it makes me nervous.
So you're going around to the neighborhoods within a certain circumference to Martin Luther King and Crenshaw, so South L.A., and it's ultimately more practical to shoot at their places than bring them to your studio.
No, I don't. I haven't. I've only brought one person to my studio who didn't seem comfortable. Like, I wanted to photograph where she worked, but she didn't seem comfortable. So But I photographed in a park. I'm a kind of controlling person in my work.
Right.
And so sometimes when I feel a little out of control, that also brings on that kind of anxiety. But I know the bottom line is I want it to be perfect.
Right.
That's just...
No, it makes sense.
You know, well, going back to one of the things that I was bringing up earlier about the photography ghetto or community or what have you, I mean, isn't being anal or very particular or perfectionistic one of the consistent qualities to photographers, wouldn't you say? Or is that necessarily?
It's so funny about that. I am really a slob.
Right.
I mean, I'm very clean, though. I'm very clean. But, you know, if you saw my studio or, like, if you went into my house and looked at my night table as opposed to my husband's night table, you would know which one was mine. Or my dresser where it starts to, like, pile up. I am kind of a mess, honestly.
I'm like that, too.
You know, and so in my life, I'm not, you know, like that. But in my work, I really do want a perfection because I'm interested in a kind of seduction that when people look at the work, they feel totally seduced by the look of the work and then they're kind of sucked in.
It's so interesting because that is actually the word that I wrote down while I was watching your videos as well was seduction and then a refusal of seduction. The way that you use your voice in your videos as well and the tempo that you use. So it's really interesting to me to hear you say that.
But one thing I do in the videos that I don't do in my still work is I try to make something funny.
Yes.
I really do. And I had this one piece that I did about all my friends who were dying or had cancer and everything.
Yeah, I saw that.
And, you know, after I looked, you know, it's just a short piece, but I thought, oh, my God. And so I put a joke at the end.
Yeah.
And I think I'm interested in that. You know, I've done sort of performance-like things as well. And, like, where I tell stories, and they're kind of comic stories. And I like to do that. But I get nervous.
Right.
I don't get... But, you know, like, we were at this party the other night, and someone said, God, I just love your lectures. You're so funny.
Right.
And then her husband said, yeah, you're a comedian. And I felt the way he said it made me uncomfortable.
Right.
Because I felt that, well, I'm not doing it to be a comedian. I want there to be substance.
Right.
And I want to use, like... somehow the comic to kind of deliver that, you know, substance.
I often think of comedy when it's used well as a recognition of context, you know, a recognition of possibly the absurdity, maybe a recognition of the profundity. But I usually see comedy when it's used the way that you use it as a kind of entry into meaning and way of delivering it.
Thank you, because that's what I really, you know, like. And even when I do lectures, too, I try and start off with a story or something. And I love to tell stories. I feel my work is about stories.
Right.
I am a storyteller. And, you know, I mean, one of the best experiences I've ever had in a lecture was when I was at the show at the Getty. It was with Carrie Mae Weems, this other artist. And so Carrie and I were giving a talk, and they said, do you mind, Carrie has a friend with Anna Deavere Smith. I don't know if you know she.
Okay, yeah, of course.
And Anna Deavere Smith has been my hero for so long. I could barely eat for days. I was so nervous about it. I could not believe how anxious I was about this, to meet her.
Right.
Because she is the epitome of everything. You know, like hard-hitting, political, and just funny, and everything. She's like everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to meet and be on a stage with this person.
Right.
But it was the best thing I ever did because she was so generous and so
lovely.
Amazing to me. Yeah.
That's
so it was the three of you were sort of each taking turns, or
what happened was Carrie and I each had not Anna, but Carrie and I each had to do a 10-minute thing, and I thought they said they wanted us to do a reading. So I developed this kind of reading, you know. And I left the last piece, which was very funny. It was from a book that Errol Morris had done. He's another one of my heroes, Errol Morris. Love his films, Errol Morris films. And then so I had people just convulsed over this. And I was nervous about it too, because I think what they someone said to me, well, you better go before Carrie because she's such a great speaker, you wouldn't want to go after her.
Oh gosh.
So already,
thanks,
I mean,
random
that,
person.
So that was that didn't do me any good.
No.
You know what I mean? And I knew Carrie, but I said, okay, fine. But it didn't really work out that way. I held my own. You know, and I think a lot of it was too because Anna Deavere Smith was very good at having a conversation like this.
Yeah.
It was like this. It wasn't, you know, she just had us all, the three of us talking. And it was a lot of fun. It was really funny and interesting and, you know, and had a lot of substance to it.
You know, I just heard this being talked about in another podcast recently. The, you know, you have these heroes, but the prospect of actually meeting them is not necessarily right. A good thing. It sounds like your expectations were actually met in this case.
It really was. Sometimes someone will say to me, oh, do you want to meet? Oh, I know you love this. Or do you want to meet him? I go, no, I don't want to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
Cause
good
what
choice.
Because yeah. What would I say? I don't, you know, I mean, I think people wouldn't believe this about me, but I'm actually shy.
Right.
I know I can get up in front of 400 people, which I have, and give a lecture, which have people laughing and then I'm at a party and I'm like in the corner.
Right.
So
you can be a public speaker and still be a heavy introvert.
Structured interaction is so different
right.
from non-structured interaction.
Well said, non-structured interaction.
Thank you.
And you're just coming off some seriously hardcore non-structured interaction, aren't you? Like the worst kind, right?
Yeah, I have a chance to write that down before we leave.
Yes, I'm glad.
Well, we're going to have it on tape. So
I charge a dime for phrases. It's my thing. Let's tell you now.
PayPal. Got you covered. Well, Eileen, thank you so much for talking
to
us.
Thank you. Oh, such a pleasure. Yeah. Truly.
Well, it was great. I really enjoyed it.
Good. And Deb?
I was nervous about this, too.
That's right. I completely forgot.
I totally forgot you were nervous. Yeah. You don't seem nervous.
You definitely sunk into it.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Thank
Indeed.
You.
Yeah. So Thank
lovely.
You, Deb.
Oh, my pleasure.
Good to have
Always
you back.
So fun. Yeah, it's good to be back. Thanks, man.
And?
We're out.
In fact, we are not out because, as I told you earlier, Eileen had something else after we finished that she felt like she neglected to mention. So we took the opportunity to jump on the phone, New Year's Eve day, actually. And here was that conversation. I will talk to you more after we finish. All right. So I understand you had a couple of things on your mind that you felt like you didn't talk about or we didn't address.
Yeah, I know, at the risk of seeming naive or some kind of overwrought crazy person, I just, when people talk about the art world and they sort of obsess about it, I just don't understand it. I don't even know what the art world is. It, to me, it's just some collectors jockeying for position. And it used to be, when we talked about the art world, it was all our friends who were artists and, you know, people who wrote about art. It wasn't about collectors or galleries. I mean, it just wasn't like that.
Right.
And when I think about the difference now between the art world, which seems so like frivolous to me, you know, and empty, and then we have the real world, which again, I don't want to seem like overwrought about it, but I always think, well, how do you, the real issue should be like, how do you make meaningful work in that world? You know, can you make something really beautiful? And can you make something funny? Can you make something political without it being a public service announcement? I mean, those to me are more thoughts worth having rather than who's selling what or what auction prices are or those kind of things.
Was there something in our conversation that made you think of this, or is this just a totally independent?
No, I think about it because sometimes I see articles that people post about the art world, and then I just think that's such a funny term, the art world. And then recently I saw, I think it was in the New York Times, an artist talked about the art world, but he wasn't talking about auctions or collectors. He was actually talking about artists. He was talking about the old art world, like artists who would sit around and talk about ideas in their work.
Right.
I don't know if it was Ellsworth Kelly because he just died. you know, but it, and then it made me think about the difference between the way people talk about the art world now or the way people used to talk about the art world back in the day.
Well, I mean, don't you think that, I'm not going to accuse you of being naive or any of those other things that you describe yourself potentially as being.
Please do.
Well, I was just going to say, isn't this transition from the art world of old that you described to the art world of new that you've also described is analogous to or similar to other worlds that have gone from, you know, compact and intimate and satisfying and all those kinds of things to unwieldy and, you know, and destroyed basically, or overrun with, you know, choose your noun. It seems like you could use that kind of description for a lot of different worlds. It's just a question
of
you know, the glory days.
You know, and the whole thing, I think it's parallel. It's, you know, when people talk about the 1% or like all those people who, the Wall Street people who are making so much money and then all this poor. Yes, it's exactly the same thing. But that to me seems more worthy of our thoughts than whether or not somebody sold their large abstract painting for $1 million.
You know, I've certainly heard stories about artists who are selling for X great number of dollars and they feel like they could get more, you know? So yeah, there's a lot of greed out there,
but the most meaningful conversations I've had about my work have recently, meaning the last 4 or 5 years, have been with curators.
Mm-hmm.
Not with other artists.
Well, let me just see if we can wrap it up this way. Don't you think that, I mean, certainly there are a lot of artists who would just be like to selling their work, and then others who are selling some work who would like to be selling more so they can quit their day job.
Of course, Michael, everybody always wants more. I mean, of everything, really. Yeah. I don't blame people for wanting more. You know, I don't blame people for saying, boy, I wish I had. But I think I mentioned to you earlier that I do sometimes wish I had a gallery so I wasn't constantly auditioning, you know.
Right, right.
But it's just that you don't have to keep going on and on about it. It is what it is. You know?
Got it. See, I think that
I'm not saying people shouldn't want it. I think it's okay to want things.
Right.
But then, you know, but just do the work. That's what it's about most. I keep saying that, but it's, you know, and stop complaining about it. It might come to you.
I see. I think you're getting to something, which is the more you complain about the way things are and the more things that you don't have, the more of a self-fulfilling prophecy it is.
Yeah. I mean, okay, so I'll tell you this thing and then, like years and years ago, like 37 years ago, you know, I was complaining to a friend, God, I wish I had a boyfriend. You know, I just really wish I did. And he said, well, stop complaining about it. And if you stop thinking about it, complaining about it, you'll meet somebody. And then a few months later, I met my husband and we've been married for 36 years. So there you go. Same thing.
How did you stop thinking about it?
I just said, you know what? I'm going to be alone. It's fine. I'm happy. I have a good life. My job's fine. I love being an artist. I love making my work. I love being with my friends. And that's, you know, I'm just not going to think about it anymore. Truly.
That's the Buddhist concept of accept the way things are, and then you get that extra thing that you wanted before.
Yeah, I mean, right. And then I was invited to a party that I didn't want to go to, but I dragged myself to go, and there was this man, and I just thought it was love at first sight. We got married 6 weeks later. Honestly, it was just
wow.
So there you go. Monday's our anniversary. 36 years.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. All right. Happy New Year.
Talk to you soon, Bye. Eileen. Thanks.
Bye.
And that really is it this time. Thank you so much to Eileen Cowan for being such a gracious guest and for recording that extra segment. It was a whirlwind of recording and editing, but we got it done, and I'm so glad we included it. I hope you got a lot out of it as well. Thanks to Depp Cloud Man as well. Wanted to remind you that this is a listener-supported podcast. This show depends on your support to keep going, and a lot of it is that is financial. So if you are able to donate to the show, it would be very much appreciated, especially if you haven't already. You can do so on the website, theconversationpod.com, by clicking on the donate button, which will take you to PayPal. And or you can certainly get the address that is direct, and you can write a check, and we get rid of that PayPal service fee. So that's another option that is appreciated. It has been a while since a significant number of people have donated, so just wanted to give you a friendly reminder about that. Of course, you can also support this show by spreading the word. You tell your friends about the show and become a fan on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And also really helps actually on a bigger picture level to let more people become aware of the show when you give a nice review on iTunes, a nice rating. That is also linked through the website. So thank you in advance for any of and all of those things that you can contribute to the show. I want to tell you that my dad recently listened to actually the longest episode of this podcast ever, which is the one with Roger White not too long ago. And he said he was very impressed. So I am grateful to have him on board. I hope you're listening now, Dad. Not an easy convert. He didn't quite get the podcast model. And I guess all of a sudden he realized that he was listening to music on his walks, and he thought, well, why don't I give this podcast thing a try? And so he listened to that one. He was, he said, I'm impressed. So great. Awesome. All right. Why don't we end there? Thank you so much for listening and for your support and for spreading the word about the show. Oh, and one other thing, people have been occasionally been writing in with questions, particularly about things that guests say. And I'm happy to entertain those questions. But even better would be if you would share those questions on a larger platform, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or, you know, posting on the site, so more people can see it and we can have a bit of a more public exchange about it, I think. So that's a little dream. All right. Thank you so much again for being here. I will talk to you next week.